This Week in Virology, the podcast about viruses, the kind that make you sick. This Week in Virology, episode number 116, recorded January 14th, 2011. Hey everybody, it's Vincent Racaniello, and this is TWIV, where we talk about viruses. Joining me today from right across the desk is none other than Dixon Despommiers.
Good afternoon, Vince.
Welcome back to TWIV.
I'm always pleased to come back to TWIV.
And I understand you've been away.
I have.
In Mexico.
We went down to Mexico and visited the Yucatan.
Excellent. Are you ready to talk about viruses?
Absolutely. I'm ready to ask stupid questions about viruses.
All right. Also with us today from Western Massachusetts is Alan Dove.
Good to be here.
Did you get a lot of snow?
Oh, boy, did we. Yeah, it snowed under the area here in Western Massachusetts, which takes some doing. Yeah, we don't snow under very easily, but...
I hear the storm stalled over Massachusetts.
Yeah, it was still all cleared within 12 hours. So. Mm.
Right.
And also joining us from sunny skies in north central Florida, Rich Condit.
Hi, fellas.
How you doing, Rich?
I'm doing great.
72 degrees?
No, 56.
Ooh. Wow.
It's chilly. It was freezing last night.
It's really cold here.
Yeah, but it's clear blue skies. That's good.
Yep. All right. Well,
last night up here, it was 4.
Ooh.
4 degrees Fahrenheit?
Yes.
Wow.
Ooh.
That is cold.
Yeah.
It was not that cold here. It was just about 30-ish, I would say.
And
right?
Then Yucatan, it was about 65. That was the coldest day we had.
You want to just go back?
Yeah.
Or did you have enough?
We had enough. No, we really had a great time. We did a big tour of the entire perimeter of the Yucatan and ended up in some remarkably beautiful places.
Bring back any viruses?
Hopefully not.
Mm. All right. Well, today we have a lot of viruses to talk about.
Cool.
I don't think we'll get through all of them, but let's start. And some very interesting stories. As usual, the first is in a journal called Molecular Therapy. With many authors, Hicks is the first author, and Crystal is the last. It's from here in New York City at Cornell. And the title is Cocaine Analog Coupled to Disrupted Adenovirus, a Vaccine Strategy to Evoke High Titer Immunity Against Addictive Drugs. How about that? Now, this is totally new for me. This hit the press this past week, right, Alan?
Yeah, to some extent.
What are the antibodies interrupting with regards to cocaine addiction?
Well, we'll see.
Okay. So there's my first stupid question.
Cool is it, and how cool is it that the Crystal Lab works on cocaine?
Actually, it should be the meth lab, shouldn't they?
Yes.
This is not something I knew about, that people were thinking of disrupting addiction with antibodies, making antibodies to cocaine or analogs. And so this is something that's been tried, but it doesn't work well.
Like blocking the receptor site, for instance, or something like that?
I think the idea is that they bind to the drug.
Bind to the drug.
Yeah. This is actually something I've followed.
You have followed it?
A little bit. I haven't done any assignments about it, but it's something that's been kind of bubbling along for a while. And I think there was actually a feature article on it a couple of years ago in Nature Medicine that was quite good. About the general field of small molecule addictive drug vaccines. And the basic idea is you've got these small molecules. They don't stimulate antibody responses by themselves, but maybe you can conjugate them to something and immunize people with that conjugate and then essentially give them an immune response against the addictive drug. And then when they go out and they relapse and they try to get high, it has no effect. Because the antibody would bind up the drug, sop it up from the bloodstream. So it would be, it would shut down the physical aspect of the addiction, which would make it a lot easier, hopefully make it a lot easier for people to get off these drugs.
So whenever they took a hit, then it wouldn't do anything.
Right, it wouldn't do anything, and then that would...
drive them crazy.
Right.
What do you
During
do?
The early stages of withdrawal, it would probably drive them nuts, but then it would be beneficial, because if they did... relapse, and relapse rates mm-hmm. are extraordinarily high for most yep. addictive drugs, particularly something like cocaine or heroin.
Mm-hmm. Just ask Lawrence Taylor.
Yeah. or any of many different celebrities.
Correct. In fact, there's a TV show now called Rehab of the Celebrities or something like that. It's an awful show. I didn't watch it. I just saw the title.
Well, they'll be the first to get on this. Maybe. All right, so here what they do, they take adenoviruses, which are approved for gene therapy applications, right? We know that they're immunogenic.
Right.
They have it deleted in E1, E3 deleted, which means they've taken out essential genes, so these cannot replicate, so they're safe. And they figured, let's conjugate one of these cocaine analogs to the capsid. They actually disrupt the virus, too. They break it up, so it's not infectious at all. I don't know. I guess that makes it more immunogenic.
Like an adjuvant of some sort.
Probably.
Yeah, it's basically working like an adjuvant.
And they put this cocaine analog, which has a long name, we'll call it GNC, and they put it onto adenovirus, and they immunize mice.
And it works.
Well, they get antibodies against the analog. They can see the antibodies in these animals. The antibodies bind cocaine. When you inject cocaine into these mice, it doesn't drive the mice crazy. They have a variety of assays.
What happens? I just love this assay. So they've got an assay where they have a little cell or cage or whatever they stick the mouse in, and they have some sort of infrared sensor above it that watches the mouse move, and they can trace the movement.
Right.
And they've got the traces displayed here. So you have straight mice over on the left, and they're just kind of moseying around.
Hey, that behavior is typical. They just hang around the sides of the cages, right?
And then you have stoned mice, and they're going nuts.
Look at this.
They're running all over the place.
But you notice there's one who just runs around the outside.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's right.
It's weird.
And then you got stoner mice over on the right, okay? They give them a little more coke.
Right, 50 micrograms.
And then they got immunized mice with both doses, and it works.
Yeah,
right. It shows that these mice, when you coke them up, they literally are bouncing off the walls.
Yes.
Yeah.
Running back and forth around their cage.
So I have a question. When the antibody combines with the antigen, and you get an antibody-antigen complex, and then it's ingested by, let's say, a macrophage and processed, what happens to the cocaine after it's released from the antibody?
I don't think we know the answer. It's a very good question.
Right.
It has
but
to
apparently
be.
Apparently, it doesn't get to the brain in any or right. to the
no,
appropriate
it gets
receptors.
Degraded, I guess, by macrophages.
Reasonable concentration.
I guess it's degraded and it's excreted at some point. That's a good point because it never reaches the target, which is the brain.
Right.
Yeah, and there's going to be a certain in the pharmacokinetics of any drug, you'll have the absorption, deposition, metabolism, excretion, and I guess what you're doing here is you're just sopping it up in the bloodstream long enough until you get to the excretion phase and enough of it is get excreted out of the blood that it won't have had any time to have its effect.
Yeah, remember, we have a nice reticuloendothelial system which filters the blood.
Yep.
So if you put viruses into the blood of mice, after a while, they're filtered out.
Got it.
Of course, unless they start to replicate.
That's right.
Same thing with these complexes. They're filtered out, but then what the fate is, we don't know. But they show here up
to... They go into the sewage system.
I was going to get to that, but I'd rather stay away from that one.
So they look in these mice for quite a few weeks after immunization, and the antibodies seem to persist. It's only up to, I think, 8 weeks maximum. So we don't know how long this would eventually last.
Lasts a long time, though.
8 weeks is a fairly long time for a mouse.
For a mouse. So for humans, it might last a long time.
Yeah.
And so this looks in the mouse model by these assays, these locomotor assays and the presence of antibodies in the blood, it looks like it worked. And the ad was quite immunogenic. So what do you think is next for this?
Clinical trials.
You think?
What I would have liked to have seen here is some kind of dose response curve. At 25 micrograms and 50 micrograms administered, these mice seem to be protected from its effects, but they didn't do a dose response where you go all the way up to a lethal dose, maybe, and see at what level you get a response. Because my concern would be if all you've done is give these mice a really high tolerance for cocaine, Then somebody who is an addict and this is trying to treat,
just take more.
Give them the vaccine, you just take more.
Right. Right.
So they don't initially get the kick from it, and so they just take more. And do you have do you get an effect at some point, or do you go straight from no effect to dead? Because either one of those would be a little disturbing. Sure.
It also raises the question of what the biological function of the receptor molecule is in the brain. Because we produce opiates all the time, endorphins and things like this, and they're painkillers, and they allow you to go beyond a certain level of physical activity. Anybody who's run for long distances, and I will count myself in that group, you can overcome these painful experiences simply by continuing to run through the pain, and you'll elicit these endorphins. So, but what if you could ablate the receptor molecule? What would be the biological effect on anything if you could do that?
It could be those receptors have other functions that you would be missing.
That's really what I'm driving at here. And
what is the receptor?
Well, I don't know, but there is a cocaine receptor. I know there is in the brain.
And yeah, but it's not just for cocaine. It's got some other purpose.
Precisely. So that's what I'm asking a larger biological question is, if you get a knockout mouse that had no receptor for the cocaine molecule, what biological effects would that have on the behavior of the mouse?
Right. Doesn't cocaine just interact with the dopamine receptor?
It does. It interacts with dopamine receptors, right?
Yep.
Right. So what I would say is, you know, what this antibody hits is not the receptor, but the cocaine, of course. which is definitely the approach to take, I think,
right.
Because it should not inhibit endogenous endorphins. And a receptor targeting approach, I think, would be a lot more problematic because the dopamine receptor system is—that's the whole motivational circuitry, pretty much. That's a hugely important thing.
Get a very flat affect human being.
Yeah.
So I think there are mouse models where, or animal models—I don't know about mouse—where you can get the animals hooked. And they can self-administer drug.
Yes.
And so I'd be interested to see if you immunize those animals, if they wind up, you know, I don't know quite how you'd set up the experiment, but basically something that more closely mimics what you're going to try and do here with humans. Because my reaction was the same as Alan's. If it's not 100%, they're just going to go out and buy more dope.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Exactly. I would want to see the dose response, and I would want to see something with an animal model that forget what it's called. But yeah, you set them up with a little treadle that they can step on, and it administers the drug to them. And you do this with mice, and they'll just repeatedly hit that spot and develop addictive behavior. And it seems like it'd be a pretty easy experiment to set up. You get them going on this addictive behavior. Then vaccinate them and then see if the behavior ameliorates.
Mm-hmm. Right.
They say here the efficacy of the disrupted adenovirus for the cocaine application indicates that it may be a general platform for small molecule vaccines. So anything where you want to make an antibody response against a small molecule could be take advantage of this.
Yeah, we used to call those heptines, but I don't know what
that's right.
Well, one of the things that we haven't mentioned here is that one of the motivations for using adenovirus for this is it's very immunogenic. Mm-hmm. They cite in the introduction here that they've tried this with smaller heptans like keyhole
hemocyanin.
Hemocyanin.
Right?
Yeah,
yeah.
KLH.
And other things like that. But adenovirus is particularly well suited to this because it behaves like an adjuvant. It is an immunostimulant.
No, it's very promising. And I would guess at some point they would go into non-human primates and then eventually into trials. So we'll see.
Right.
Could be cool. I think it's an interesting application.
Someone who got involved in this as a victim of drug addiction, however, would really have to want to be cured of recidivism by this vaccine in a rehab center.
Yeah. It couldn't be walking around, right?
Nah, this is not like the guy on the street that's relapsed again and again.
Yeah,
this is administered through a rehab center.
That's right.
Alan,
there's a huge population of people who want to get off drugs, genuinely want to, and they end up in rehab and they end up clean for a period of time.
Sure,
and then they relapse, and that's the the recidivism rate is made up, I don't have the data at hand, but from what my wife's experience in psychiatry, the recidivism seems to be made up mostly of people who would really rather not be taking these drugs.
Yeah, but then wouldn't they just turn to another drug then if this one was blocked? How many vaccines do you need in order to keep them off all addictive drugs?
Well, yeah, that's kind of the gateway drug hypothesis, right? You
know, I looked at
but
this.
That doesn't...
Oh, go ahead.
I'm not sure that really applies to a lot of addicts. I think the drug of choice is still the drug of choice.
Or whatever you can get.
Maybe.
Mm. Like the Midwest, it is crystal meth.
I wonder, could you do this with heroin? How big is heroin?
It's not big.
Don't know.
I think it's similar size. I don't see why this wouldn't work with any reasonably small molecule.
Unless it was so close to a naturally occurring molecule that it
would tolerized as self. Exactly.
So we're going to wind up with multivalent vaccines, right?
Yeah, it sounds like it.
That would be the approach I would suggest. Interesting. But, you know, if you go to another entity, completely different but similar thought process, for all the diarrheal disease-causing organisms, you go to a country such as Bangladesh, and you say, wouldn't it be great if we had a vaccine against Salmonella? And then you say, well, what about Shigella? And what about Giardia? What about rotavirus? What about, you know, if you take all the diarrheal disease-causing agents... Mm-hmm. And you only address a few of them with a vaccine. You've still got these other things sitting out there. So,
and the others become more prominent as you take away.
So. Right. So the best approach is sanitation in that case. So in this case, prevention, what did they say? An ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure.
Well, you know how it works, Dixon. You provide solutions.
Kilo, in this case, it's a kilo of cure. Yeah,
you provide solutions and you see which ones float to the surface.
Yeah, well, they haven't got an answer for this. How long has this been going on?
I don't know.
When I was at Rockefeller as a postdoc, this guy, Jules Hirsch, was just getting involved with the addiction problem using methadone as a substitute addictive drug, but which didn't alter your attitude.
Right.
It was addictive, just like a heroin, but it didn't alter your attitude. So you could maintain a presence of social behavior and still be addicted to a drug. I mean, you still had to go for it. And it turned out that methadone addicts, as they were called after a while, were selling the methadone at the methadone clinic to non-methadone addicts.
Right.
Now, the crazy stuff goes on at some level.
Well, the reason for that is that people who are addicted to heroin, if they don't get a fix, they're going to go through physical withdrawal.
Yeah, that's right.
And so they need a fix of either heroin or methadone.
No question.
And that's why there's a black market for it.
Yeah.
It's for people who couldn't get heroin. They'll get the methadone, even though it won't really get them high. They'll be able to take that and they'll get their next fix.
Oh, that's exactly right. So has it been a successful program? It's been in operation now for about 40 years. Has drug addiction at that level gone down? Or has it been controlled?
There's a lot of controversy about that.
Still!
About the efficacy of methadone and
Well, that's for TWID.
Exactly.
That's right. TWID.
This is TWID. We just talk about the vector, and it looks like it looks immunogenic.
So
I think it's
another
cool
question I would have in this case is then, are there other viruses which would be even better than adenovirus for vaccine development? Isn't it targeting to a specific immunogenic organ?
Is that what's going on here? No, this is going everywhere.
Why does this turn out to be such a particularly good adjuvant?
Yeah, well, that's a good question. They break it up. They make it adjuvant. They have a lot of protein there. It's conjugated. It works. Is there a better one?
Yeah, I think the reason adeno has ended up at the top of the heap here is just, you know, it's people use it because people use it.
Got it.
It was a well-studied virus that was available, and then it was used, and then it was studied, and now we have a pretty good grasp of how the immune response against adeno works, and so
and you can take out genes and make it replication defective. You can actually gut all the genes and make it gutless.
Yeah, in the past, you used to connect these things up to bovine serum albumin.
Mm-hmm.
The small molecules were then linked and then injected, and then you'd get an antibody against BSA, and you'd get an antibody against the heptine. Plus BSA.
Well, here you're getting probably
antibodies against adeno.
Adeno as
well. Sure, you are, of course.
And the immunogenicity of the adenovirus vector, in fact, has been a problem for gene therapy.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Because people have an immune response,
already.
An inflammatory response
to
the vector.
Exactly.
Right.
Exactly.
And that can be a really dangerous side effect.
Here.
In fact, we talked about that in using these for HIV immunization, that in some cases, the incidence of AIDS was higher in the immunized individuals, probably because you got an inflammatory response and CD4 cells were increasing in numbers, which are what? The sites of replication of HIV. So
just making more targets.
Yeah.
Right.
Dear, dear.
Okay, our next story is also quite interesting. Well, they all are, right? We wouldn't pick them.
Yeah, you really rounded up some bizarre stories this week.
It's a little bizarre here.
These are great.
Well, come on, we're at the 116. What's left?
Oh, plenty.
Well, I was just joking.
Good. Glad you were. This is called large-scale field application of RNAi technology reducing Israeli acute paralysis virus disease in honeybees. In bees. This is a field trial of RNAi in bees.
Assuming colony collapse syndrome is due to that.
Well, that's a good question. They actually have a nice discussion in the beginning, as we have talked about here on TWIV.
Right.
You know, people have tried to figure out what is causing colony collapse disorder, and a number of viruses, including Israeli acute paralysis virus, have been implicated.
Right.
The most recent one, which we discussed, I don't know if you were here for that, was a virus and a fungus together, Nosema fungus and IIV.
No, I wasn't here for that.
What is
Hirudovirus.
Hirudovirus.
No, I wasn't here for that one.
So the two together seem to be important.
And it sounds to me from reading their introduction as if this study was going on or was initiated when they thought IAP may be the deal.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And during the process of the study, that other paper came out. So they acknowledge all that in the introduction.
Right.
They say, well, IAP may... if I got that right, this... it is IAP, Israeli acute paralysis virus. Said, well, okay, so it turns out that may not be it, but, you know, the results are interesting anyway.
Yeah, they say basically it may not cause CCD, but it does cause mortality in hives.
And the results are interesting. Yeah, as we discussed last week or the week before, the beekeepers say, you know, colony collapse disorder is not their number one problem necessarily. So all of these things could be problems. And the therapy they're describing here could apply to a lot of different agents. Yeah. So
mites. Mites are also a big problem.
Yeah.
Yeah. In fact, totally in the discussion, they talk about, I think they even discuss it as the multi-pathogen, CCD multi-pathogen syndrome.
Yeah.
So colony collapse disorder, you see this whole pack of stuff affecting the hives. You get the Microsporidium Nosema.
Right.
You get varroa mites. You get viruses, including IAPV, including
sounds like immunodeficiency disease in bees.
Yeah, it really it sounds like these bees are just susceptible to whatever hits them.
So in this study, what they did is they designed an RNAi, a short interfering RNA, and put it in the sugar water that they feed the bees. And they did two studies, one in Florida and one in Pennsylvania, two different hives, 160 hives total in the two different locations. And they put this in the water. And then they measure various parameters of the health of the bees. And they also look to see if, in fact, virus-specific RNAi is being generated.
I was interested that they also deliberately infected some bees, right?
That's right. Sorry, I forgot that. They deliberately infected some bees.
Yeah, that would have been essential.
To see the effect of the RNAi.
So they've got hives that are no treatment. They've got this RNAi they call Remibee.
That's the name of it,
right?
Yep.
Remibee treated only. Remibee plus virus. Virus only. Okay?
Right.
And then an isolated control as well, I guess, to control for connection between among the hives. I was really interested in, I'm always interested in the techniques. Okay. I was interested in how they grew the virus because this is not a virus that they've cultured. So they found some PCR positive beads, ground them up and made a filtered extract and used that to inject 700 pupae. And then let those cook for a while and then made an extract of those guys. They had, I don't know, like 50, 100 mils or something like that of ultimately a filtered extract of this thing that ought to have the virus in it, and then mixed that with water. And I was also really interested that they can apparently administer the double-stranded RNA just in the water.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So this virus they made, did they have a titer?
I think they may have had, because they can't do it like a plaque assay.
Yeah, right.
They can't grow it. They may have had a PCR titer. I'll have to look at that again.
An LD50.
They don't, it doesn't, you know, it doesn't really even knock out the bees that well, I don't think.
One thing I've got out of this is that the results are very different in the two locations, which underscores how difficult these field studies are, because you have such different conditions in Florida, as we know, from Pennsylvania.
Yeah, and they had to do it at different times of the year, of course. And then they also, apparently, the Pennsylvania hives just didn't do as well. They yes, had just not right. as productive, not as many bees, more problems. And I mean, just the idea of doing your experiment out in the weather.
So it involves, they have to count bees. They have to count bees coming and going, foraging, see how many return. They weigh the hive to measure the honey production. They also looked in individual bees for RNAi production. So it's quite a project, actually.
Yeah.
I got tired reading it.
I don't see that they've got any titer on the virus that they made. I think they're flying blind here.
So, for example, figure one, total change in the total bee population in Florida, you know, percent, number of bees as a percent. You can see that when they treat with IAPV, the numbers stay the same, controls stay the same, but when they put the RNAi with IAPV, there's an increase in the number of bees at the end of the project. So presumably the RNAi's help them survive because it's interfering with virus.
Now,
but I don't understand why why isn't there an increase in the control?
Change. Well, this is the total bee population. I guess it stays pretty much the same, right?
Well, in that case, it's almost as if the Remibee and IAPV treatment is stimulating.
Stimulating, yeah.
You know.
Well, I think that the IAPV. Is keeping the numbers down, right?
Uh-huh.
I think they mentioned at one point that they thought the virus might be spreading to their control bees and impacting on them. It's hard to control for that, right? Because if you infect some of the hive, even if you put them far away, it might be hard to do that. So, yeah.
Well, and they, with the exception of the isolated controls, they had all these hives in the same place.
Yeah. So that could be. I don't understand that. That's a good question. Maybe some beekeeper listening to us can address that.
And by the way, beekeeping has become an urban, not just a hobby.
Really?
But it's now a way of making a living. Yeah, they've just recently passed variances for Brooklyn, and I believe Manhattan also, to allow beekeeping to occur.
Red honey, right?
Well, yeah, right. Were you around?
Were you around for the show, Dixon?
I might have been.
I had a New York Times article where bees were visiting the maraschino cherry factory.
I was here for that.
The honey was red.
Sure.
They have hive weight gain here, so they have controls. Certain weight kilograms. Then with the virus, it goes down and decreases the honey production. Then the virus plus Remibee goes up over the controls. So the production is better with the Remibee than the controls. Again, it's interesting, right?
Now, given how hard this experiment is, as we already mentioned, I hate to pick on them, but the thing that I was kind of hoping for here is that they would have included a control RNAi, like an RNAi that would expected to inhibit this virus.
Yeah, that's right.
Sure. Because one of the concerns I have about the whole RNAi field is something that happened with the antisense field, if you remember back that far. It turns out that antisense DNA is kind of generically immunostimulatory.
So it
ramps up the immune response, but not against anything in particular, which meant that this, what people thought was going to be a whole category of new drugs, actually turned out to be only one new drug and not a very specific one at that. And RNAi appears to be a little better than that, but there's some evidence that maybe it's not exactly working the way we think it is. And so I think whenever you employ it, it is important to employ a control RNA that's like your experimental one, but different enough that you wouldn't expect it to work, to see if things are working the way you think they are.
Right.
Indeed.
Because if this were just an immune stimulator, you could see exactly the result.
Yep.
Yeah, that would be good. Another interesting... Sorry, go ahead.
So little is known about insect or arthropod immunity and the basis for it.
Right.
I know that there were a whole bunch of early studies back in the 50s and 60s out of the University of California at Berkeley for insect pathologists that were extremely interested in, in commercial bee populations in particular, but also for insects that control other insects, like ladybugs that control aphids and things like this. And they were running into tremendous problems of trying to raise enough insects to actually make a difference because they would become infected with things. So they went off on a tangent and started to study their immune systems per se. And it's where we learned that there are about three or four different kinds of hemocytes that circulate throughout the hemocoel of an insect that play a role in controlling diseases, and that molecules similar to antibodies, but not antibodies themselves, can be made in response to an infection. But it's still at a fairly primitive level of understanding how invertebrates handle infections, basically. And a lot of them tolerate these things.
There are many symbiotic infections as well.
Yeah, right? Or they don't have the same effects you'd expect to have on a mammalian system, for instance.
Wolbachia.
There you go. For example.
Yeah.
So, I mean, to have expectations, Alan, for the same things that you'd get for interfering with RNA synthesis via the blocking RNAs, basically, versus the RNAis here, this may be a whole different system that we're dealing with in terms of the way insects resist things.
Sure.
So... You know, I don't have an answer here either, but I'm just raising these as interesting questions.
They also the interesting figure four, they look at Nosema spore counts. This is this fungus that's been associated together with IIV, with CCD.
Yeah.
And the virus alone seems to increase the fungal spore counts, and if you put the RNAi in, it decreases the Nosema. So there seems to be a health effect. Right, you get rid of virus, you get rid of fungus.
Maybe there's an association there.
Like yeah. They also mentioned that someone has done an RNAi study against Nosema. And so they say that worked. So maybe you could do both of these together,
really?
Nosema and IAPV RNAi. So clearly we're going to see a lot more of this in the end.
I mean, my perspective is from the mosquito perspective.
Yeah.
And when you think about all the diseases that mosquitoes transmit, and very few of them actually affect the behavior of the mosquito.
And I think a lot of that is because of the RNAi system or the RNA interference system in bees and insects, for example, mosquitoes. We did some papers last year on Twitter where they keep the virus levels down so the mosquitoes survive.
Yes.
Without it, they kill the mosquitoes.
Right. Yeah. But encephalitis viruses appear to be an exception to that.
How so, Dixon?
Because they are transmitted vertically and everybody seems to have it. Mm-hmm. Like, for instance, West Nile or a lot of the other encephalitides. And the behavior of the insects don't appear to be altered very much.
I'm not surprised.
Well, considering how many tissues are infected inside the insect, it's amazing that they can tolerate such high
levels. Yeah, no, it is amazing, but we will figure it out and learn and apply.
We will.
I like this table which summarizes all of this in Florida versus Pennsylvania. Actually, and what we didn't mention is that they did check RNAi levels, siRNAs, and they were elevated in Florida, but they didn't look in Pennsylvania. The mean bee population per hive at the end of the trial, Florida greater in the Remibee-treated group, not significantly different in Pennsylvania. Mean adult forager activity. Do you know what that means to when bees forage, Dixon?
I do.
They go out and they come back, right?
I do.
In Florida, progressively greater difference. And in Pennsylvania, too much variability. Total weight gain greater in the Remibee-treated group in Florida and Pennsylvania. Nosema levels not different in Florida, but, as we said, lower in the Remibee group in Pennsylvania.
Yeah.
And Varroa mites were not affected by this treatment.
I love the way they assayed the forager activity. They had people go out to the hives and for 60-second intervals count how many bees landed on the entrance to the hive.
There was a wonderful demonstration one year up here at the New York Botanical Garden of bee behavior, and it was by a graduate from Carl von Frisch's laboratory, guy's name was Harold Esch, who taught at Notre Dame, and I actually knew this guy. They would put little fluorescent orange spots of paint on the backs of these bees at the site of feeding. And so when they came back into the hive, you could recognize which bee had just returned from what concentration of sucrose solution that they made up. And the higher the concentration, the more vigorous the waggle dance. And the waggle actually pointed in the direction of where the source was, so they could teach the bees how much there is and where to go for it. So I can understand why there's big worries about this, because maybe these viruses interfere with the waggle dance behavior or something else that would be offsetting, and therefore maybe they can't even find their way back home. You know, like a non-GPS virus. Anti-GPS.
So there you go, the first field trial of RNAi.
Yeah, it's cool. It's a hard experiment. They're getting some effects.
You're right. You're absolutely right.
And it's very interesting.
Where are they from, by the way?
Florida.
USDA.
USDA.
USDA in Florida.
Maryland.
Okay.
Yeah, University of Florida.
All right. Not a bad school, right, Rich?
Not a bad school. Yeah, there's a whole bunch of...
A company called B-Logix.
Rich, this is in Gainesville.
There you go.
Some of it.
Yeah.
That's right. There's a lot of field stations in Florida that are attached to the university.
Wow.
It's a very active community.
Oh, yeah. No, it's great.
We did a paper last week from Gainesville as well. That was my pick. The strawberry genome was sequenced.
Yep. Ah.
What's going on here?
I'll be darned.
Yeah.
So, Alan, you could write a little blurb on this and call it the buzz on colony collapse disorder.
Yes.
Wanted to.
They have a supplementary file here. This is in PLOS One, so everyone can see it. And they have photographs of the way the hives were set up. And
nice.
Oh, I didn't look at that.
Treatment, yeah. And the foraging results. Very interesting stuff.
So another thought that occurs to me, I hate to waste so much time here, but I haven't been here for a while, so
it's okay.
Please bear with me, is that there's a similar but different cause of the collapse of amphibians throughout the world right now that everybody's worried about. And it appears to be that it's a central failure of the immune system that prevents certain infections from occurring. Mm-hmm. And the frog skin has a lot to do with its immunity because it produces these things called meganins, right, which are shield-like molecules, right, related to gramicidin. So if UVB radiation levels are increasing due to the ozone hole depletion phenomenon, then couldn't some of this also be due to that? And bees, because they're outdoors all the time.
Sure, environmental changes, why not?
That's right. So it would be interesting to see if there's a difference in colony collapse syndrome in areas of low UVB radiation versus areas of high UVB radiation, for instance.
I think we should build vertical farms and get rid of the ozone problem and reverse all this. What do you think?
Well, I can't agree.
Well,
with
the ozone. My understanding is the ozone problem is gradually reversing itself since the CFC
Very gradually, though.
Yeah, that's because of CFCs. It has nothing to do with farming, right, Dixon?
Nothing. No, nothing to do.
I want to relate everything to vertical farming.
You can't, Vince. Sorry about that.
All right.
It doesn't all relate to that.
Our third story is a paper that just came out yesterday, I believe.
Wow. Yep.
In Science.
Hot off the press.
And Alan had alerted us to this. It's called Suppression of Avian Influenza Transmission in Genetically Modified Chickens.
I told you you had a weird lineup today.
It's very interesting. Very interesting.
Cool.
Basically, they make transgenic chickens, which express a short piece of RNA, which is a mimic of the end of the flu viral RNA. All right, so there are 8 influenza A RNAs. They have all a conserved sequence at the end, which is recognized by the RNA polymerase. So they make this little decoy in the chickens, and that blocks viral replication.
Good thing they didn't make a decoy in the ducks.
That's pretty good.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Well,
do you like that, Alan?
Considering.
That is good. Yeah.
It's a decoy.
He says politely.
So here we are.
No, he said jealously.
They show these hairpins inhibit viral replication in culture, and then they make transgenic chickens, and they infect them with a highly pathogenic H5N1 strain. And the interesting thing here is that the chickens that are infected, they die, but they do transmission experiments, and they don't transmit it very well to their neighbors. Their neighboring chickens.
Right.
Yeah. This figure 2 in the paper, I think it's a closed access paper, so people probably can't pull this up, but there's this incredibly data dense figure in the paper right. that's pretty much the whole
experiment, right? Yeah.
I mean, it's actually the second study that they did, but it's the whole essence of the thing. And they infected non-transgenic versus transgenic chickens, and then they exposed different groups of them to either non-transgenic or transgenic secondary contacts, and they looked at the transmission rates. And yeah, it looks like this transgene is somewhat protective for the initial infection, but it seems to be highly protective against transmitting the virus subsequently. So a lot of these transgenic birds that they infected with a reasonable dose of virus ended up dying anyway.
Right. But they
transmitted as well.
It is puzzling, and I think it, from reading a paper, it puzzled them as well, because it looks like the initially infected transgenic chickens actually, as you point out, Alan, get sick and die, and they, from the titers, it looks like they make reasonable quantities of virus.
Yeah.
So why it should be interrupted in transmission is not clear at all. It doesn't make a lot of sense.
Now, the transmission is done to also transgenic chickens, right?
Either transgenic or not transgenic chickens.
They're both
works
protected,
either way.
Right? Yeah.
So they take the infected chickens and they, just to make it clear, they stick them in a cage with uninfected chickens and ask whether the uninfected chickens get sick. All right?
So they're not shedding virus at a very high rate then?
Well, that's not clear because they've got virus all over them. They're in the organs. They assayed the chickens.
Yeah.
So the transgenic chickens make a lot of virus.
But I meant shedding as outside the chicken.
Well, I don't think did they assay that?
Yeah, they did buccal swabs and cloacal swabs, mouths and rear ends. And they assayed that. It is all packed into, I think that's mostly packed into figure two as well.
And
right, so there is virus there.
There's virus there. It does seem that at least some of the transgenic birds are producing less virus than the non-transgenic birds. But then, you know, they infect five transgenic birds and put them in contact with 12 transgenic birds, you know, as a secondary contact in one panel of this. So we're not dealing with huge numbers here, but. You know, just looking at one of them where you had transgenic birds in contact with non-transgenic birds, the transgenics that were exposed to the virus, it looks like one of them survived all the way through the experiment with no detectable virus. Another one survived for a week before it got sick and they killed it because it was too sick. And then three others got morbidly sick by the second day of the experiment and had to be put down. And those had the three that only survived a couple of days all had detectable virus in them. So compare that to something like the non-transgenics, where if you take the non-transgenic chickens, you give them all this virus. By day two, a couple of them are found dead in the cage. One of them has to be put down. The next day, another one's found dead in the cage. And on day five, another one has to be put down, and they're all dead. So the virus does seem to take more of a toll, and it does seem to produce higher titers in the non-transgenic chickens. But it's not the kind of difference I would have expected. I mean, it's not that the transgenic chickens are really protected against this. And I think that's what's surprising here is you'd kind of expect this to be an all or nothing thing. But it's the protection is really pretty weak, and yet the transgenic chickens don't transmit the virus very well.
Well, like the first paper that we did, one thing that's missing here that I would have thought would be the first experiment you do is a dose response.
Yes.
Right.
Okay. Take the transgenic chickens and give them increasing doses of the virus and see if there's a difference in their resistance that way. During the course of this paper, they only did two doses. And it could be that if you backed off and really did a dose response, you'd see a clearer difference.
Right. Yeah. On the other hand, what I found really, really bizarre was the experiment where they infected non-transgenic chickens. So, you know, these all end up dying within a week. But they put them in association with transgenic chickens. So in other words, the second round of this infection should carry on more or less like you'd see in a chicken rearing environment.
Right.
And in that experiment, this is really, really strange. So you've got the non-transgenic chickens, you've got five of them, they've been deliberately infected with the virus, they're pecking around in the cage with the transgenic chickens in contact with them. And all 12 of the transgenic chickens in that experiment, 11 of them, either died or had to be put down because they were so sick.
Hmm.
So apparently when the virus is transmitted under kind of natural-ish conditions, these transgenic chickens are not particularly well protected.
Well, they're not protected by inoculation either, right?
They're, right.
No.
The only ones protected are the ones who get it by transmission from a transgenic chicken.
From a transgenic chicken, which immediately made me think, okay, so the virus is mutating in these chickens, but they looked for that and it doesn't seem to be.
Mm.
Right.
The big question is, if you were a science editor and reviewer, would you have accepted this article for publication?
There's one thing I would have liked. Now, all of the virus levels is done by RNA. Mm. There's no infectivity assay here.
No plaques.
No good plaques.
Point. No plaques.
So I don't know if that's telling the whole story. I would have liked infectivity because maybe the RNA levels, maybe there's some, because of the decoy, there's a defect in the RNA of some sort. I think infectivity may have provided that. And this is kind of a high-profile paper, right? It's pathogenic, sure. H5N1. It's an interesting approach. Science wants to publish it. It would probably take a long time to get the viral titers if they even have the samples anymore.
Right.
So I would like to have seen that. I think it's important. I don't find it here. I've been looking.
No, I don't think
I don't think it's in there. And that's a really good point because you could have some kind of RNA packaging error, which would explain why the chickens that get the virus from a transgenic chicken don't get as sick.
Exactly.
Or don't get sick at all. Whereas even when the transgenic chickens catch it from a wild type chicken, they die.
Right. So that I would like to see that. But yeah. let's say this works. It's a good approach, Dixon. What would you do with it? They say we could make other animals transgenic and resistant to flu. Now
you'd have to make them all. I mean, you'd have to have an entire herd of chickens, a flock of chickens that's all transgenic in order for this.
Well, I wonder about that because if you talk about herd immunity here, if you spike a flock with enough transgenic chickens, maybe you can reduce the transmission sufficiently to stop or interrupt any sort of epidemic. Just an idea.
Now, I like the last sentence here. Further development of transgenic disease resistance in poultry and other farm animals will undoubtedly stimulate debate about the application of this technology in food production. Are you going to eat a transgenic chicken?
Brilliantly understated.
Yeah. That's right.
Yeah.
It rivals the Watson and Crick last line in their paper.
Yes. That's a good point, right?
Considering how the transgenic salmon have been received so far.
Or transgenic anything.
What are the transgenic salmon for?
Well, they're for fish farming.
They grow faster.
And the FDA, last I heard, FDA was still pondering whether to approve them.
Right.
They grow. By some reports, twice as fast as regular salmon, and therefore you don't have to. You get a quicker turnaround time, you get more profit, and you presumably have to feed them less than you would non-transgenic salmon. Salmon farming has big impacts on the environment. So the hope is that this would be a more ecologically sound and more commercially viable way of farming salmon. The concern is this would be the first transgenic animal approved for human consumption. And what are we opening the floodgates to? And I haven't decided on that issue. But there's a lot of vigorous debate about it.
A quarter of the world eats transgenic rice already.
Oh, transgenic plants are already very...
So, I mean, you know, tell me... Where do you go?
So there's no difference, really.
Not a difference, but what is the danger is what I'm asking.
Well, transgenic rice doesn't tend to swim out into the ocean and mate with other...
No. Usually, you know what? The thing that's missing there, in my view, because A, I love fishing, and B, I'm very familiar with the life cycle of salmon. The thing that's missing in these transgenic animals is some built-in device that prevents them from surviving in the wild. Do you remember the hue and cry that went up in Cambridge, Massachusetts, for the first genetically modified organism ever? Jonathan Beckwith was the guy who did this, and he actually isolated a gene. He was the first one, right? And he also transfected E. coli. And everybody was saying, you're creating monster bacteria that'll get loose and kill us all. And it turned out that they were weaker. When you threw them down the drain, they just died.
Right.
So you can build that into these things and to prevent them. You can make sterile hybrids, for instance, that you can make all the time. In fact, Pioneer Corn does this all the time. That's a no-brainer, okay? You could make transgenic salmon that were totally sterile as an F1. You do two crosses from two hybrid strains, which gives the characteristics of fast growth and no reproductive capacity, and grow them. Or just make them all males, or make them all females. All males would be better. So that's the whole deal here. This is so stupid for not thinking about that.
Well, one of
the industry could avoid all this criticism by doing it.
Right. Well, one of the stipulations the FDA is looking at is that it would only be for landlocked salmon farms.
But yeah,
the concern there is how do you
fish got to swim, birds got to fly. Come on, you know the
and
song.
And how do you ensure that nobody transfers them?
That's crap. I don't believe that for a minute either. And landlocked salmon, by the way, that's no guarantee, because if you break down the landlocked barrier for landlocked salmon, they become regular salmon again.
Oh, I don't mean landlocked salmon in the traditional ichthyological way. I mean ones that are penned up in the middle of a field.
Got it.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, you know, it's...
Yeah, I don't... There are no easy answers there.
No, it's easy if you just build in a sterility gene. That's easy. That's dead easy. That's dead simple.
I will predict that this is all going to happen, and we're going to have all kinds of modified farm animals in the coming years, and we'll see interesting interactions.
We already saw what happened with diethylstilbestrone, didn't we?
Explain, okay. Dixon.
DEC was the fast hormone growth rate for cattle.
Mm-hmm.
And in women who ingested the meat, they didn't get uterine cancer, but their female offspring did.
Wow.
It skipped a generation, but it was still attributable to the DEC levels in the meat that they ate.
I mean, we put growth hormone into cows, right?
Right.
That ends up in kids who drink milk. Isn't there an effect on the growth of kids as a consequence?
Well, probably the growth hormone, since it's a peptide, it's destroyed in the stomach before it actually goes through. But still.
Yeah, if you could get a physiological effect by drinking a protein, biotech companies would be dancing in the streets about it.
Exactly. Right. Except newborns, by the way, which have the capacity to absorb all the proteins from the mother.
Yeah.
So those are the big danger groups, though, right?
A lot of stuff to think about.
I think
everybody should breastfeed.
I think there's interesting stuff in the future.
It's nature's best milk container.
Transgenic animals, interactions with pathogens. It is going to be, I think everyone needs to be a scientist.
Hear, hear. Yep.
There's so much to do.
And guess what? One of the congressmen who's now leaving office is a physicist by training, and he laments the lack of science and understanding in Congress.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really, who the hell among us would ever run for office and aspire to that high office? Who?
No, thanks.
Yeah,
no.
See? Nobody wants it because you become a target for public criticism and all kinds of other things, right?
And bullets.
And, well, that's kind of a trivial issue.
Yeah.
But I don't mean to trivialize the event, but...
It is a rare event,
that wouldn't
yes.
be my biggest fear. Character assassination no. rather than physical would be my biggest fear. I mean... You know, it's just a crazy world out there.
Yeah.
Let's do some email.
Hey.
These are people who want to know about science.
They want to know about that.
First one's from Sky. Hey, Vince, Dick, and the gang. I just wanted to get your thoughts on the current state of an issue that came up in an old television production that I just watched. I had always heard that the usage of phage particles to treat bacterial infections was impractical, since the virus particles could only spread so long as there was enough of a density of host cells in an area that they could continue to replicate. That is, it made sense that a phage could not successfully kill off every living bacterial cell in a natural environment, i.e. within an organism, rather than in a fluid suspension or a petri dish, since they could only spread by Brownian motion and not hunt down the bacterial cells. But then I watched this show on phage treatments, which made a lot of sense, but it's quite old, and I'm sure that a lot of work has been done since then. Could you tell us what the current state of this work is? All right, so he has another question, but we'll do that first. So treatment of infections with phages. You know anything about that, Dixon?
Not a thing.
How about you, Rich?
A little bit. You know, I mean, that when phage were first discovered, that idea came up immediately. As a matter of fact, a lot of the original work that De Harel did was motivated by using bacteriophage to try and treat bacterial diseases. I think
and Rebecca Lensfield, too. Don't forget
He isolated phage from people with dysentery and actually tried to treat people with it. And there's there were a lot of pharmacists that grew phage and sold them for phage therapy, though I don't think they necessarily did any good. As a matter of fact, as I understand it, at least the lore is that a lot of the original T phages that were used by some of the early phage researchers, like Max Delbruck and Salvador Luria, were acquired from pharmacists. Okay.
Interesting.
And that's where they got their phage to start with. It is ongoing. I have right on my desk here a vial of something that my colleague Donna Duckworth brought back to me from her visit to the state of Georgia in the Soviet Union, or former Soviet Union. The English on it says intestiphage, and then it's got a lot of other writing that's, you know, obviously some other language. And there it is. Nice file of stuff.
Yeah, I think the Soviet Union and perhaps part of some of the states, former states, still have an active program in using phages. This show that he links to is partly describing that.
You dug up a bunch of articles here, Vincent.
So someone told me that basically it's mostly being explored for topical bacterial infections, because once you put the phage inside people, it gets turned over, you have antibody responses and so forth. I found a couple of interesting papers. One is in PLOS One, where they use a tail spike protein of a phage as a antibacterial. It agglutinates the salmonella in this case, and they're trying to use that as treatment, because they say that you know, people have tried to use phages, but they haven't really worked that way for a variety of studies, but using bits of them might work. There's a fellow here in New York at the Rockefeller, Vincent Fischetti, who
I know his father.
He actually purifies the lysins encoded by phages. The lysins are proteins that lyse bacteria, and he's trying to use those as therapy. And again, he is mostly using it in topical applications, mucosal surfaces, for example, and he's been doing this for many years, and I have a couple of links to that. So there's still some activity, but the idea, if you had a systemic bacterial infection, I don't think you could use these. Maybe the proteins someday, but the phages themselves, I don't think that's going to work.
What about I would expect even the proteins would induce an immune response and be
right.
Yeah, you're absolutely right.
That's one of the problems is that you get antibodies to the therapies. Okay, right. So it compromises their effectiveness over time. Plus, in terms of phage therapy, another problem is the bacteria can acquire resistance really quickly.
True, right. And then third, probably a specificity of the phage itself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Which bacteria would you be going after here?
Yeah, you'd have to know what's in you first, right?
That's a fact.
Okay, so then he goes on, also I read recently about the transmission of HIV through viral bridges and realized that virus particles didn't necessarily depend on Brownian motion to propagate. That also seems to make the possibility of using a hunter-killer virus rather than a naval mine, I suppose, more likely. That is, the spread of the virus there seems much more active than the image I usually have in mind. Please let me know your thoughts. This is a subject that has been on my mind increasingly since a MRSA infection drilled a fascinatingly neat little hole in my back a few weeks ago.
Ow.
Eek.
Love both shows. Keep them coming. So the idea of viral bridges, yes. Now, Rich, you know about this for pox viruses,
yeah,
right?
Sure. I mean, we did a whole show on that. The notion that pox viruses are transmitted by exocytosing and sitting on the surface of the cell and inducing from within the cell the polymerization of an actin tail that causes this big filament to come out with a virus perched on the end of it, and then actually actively places that virus on a neighboring cell. And it actually works out that the cell has to be uninfected to be reinfected, or it gets passed on again. So it's a very active process that passes virus around from cell to cell and specifically seeks out uninfected cells.
Yeah, a number of other viruses do this. They don't have to spread in the medium. They can go from cell to cell. HIV-1 is one of them. It makes what's called a viral synapse. So two cells are very close, and the virions come out of one and go through a structure, a very specific structure, right into the next cell. Measles, herpes, I think.
Wow.
And in fact, the cool thing about this HIV synapse, there is a antiviral protein called tetherin. It's an interferon-induced protein that grabs the virions and prevents them from going through this synapse. So that's how it works. It blocks the synaptic transmission of HIV from one cell to another.
Remarkable.
This is all pretty recent stuff. So yes, Sky, there are ways that viruses can get around without floating.
This review that you dug up that basically reviews that whole topic is really nice.
It's very good.
Because okay? it has a lot of nice pictures of all the different ways that viruses can get around. And it considers it very well. It's a really nice review.
Unfortunately, Nature Reviews Microbiology is behind a paywall, so most people won't be able to see it. But you can see the abstract.
I'm sure they're making
the library.
I'm sure they're making a fortune doing that too.
It's their business, right?
Yeah. Well,
our next email was actually posted on my blog, virology.ws. We have a poll there. Our virus is living, and this gentleman, whose name is Discuss3, he wrote this very interesting thought, and I thought I would share it. It's about the idea of our virus is living. I was a computer programmer for 40 years. During that time, I created some things from scratch, editor, computer language, etc. But I also found some other programs written by others, which I modified so much you could hardly see the origins anymore. Some of those hacks were more useful than the programs I wrote from scratch. So that empty bacterial shell, he's talking about the Venter creation of a bacteria, that empty bacterial shell is simply some old code that Venter decided to hack rather than write from scratch. Some of the programs I hacked, I later went back and studied, eventually writing new code from scratch to do the same thing, but with cleared up algorithms. I also moved to larger computers along the way. When I first started hacking code, I couldn't see how anyone could write huge programs. Then I learned about modularization. Then I learned about the division of labor and interfaces. Almost everything I ever learned about computers has some parallel in cell biology, with millions of brilliant minds reverse engineering everything inside that empty shell, will simply create programming libraries for DLLs or DLLs of all the components in a cell. I probably won't live long enough to see it, but sans self-destruction, I'd say in 30 to 50 years, we'll be building living cells from parts the same way we build new computer chips and drivers. In fact, it's all pretty much software nowadays. And this is the good part. I think we should call it visual biology, since our tools will be pretty high level by then. Want your microbe to have a propeller? Just click on Add Genetic Component.
This is actually something I think I commented on my blog about this a year or two ago with the synthetic biology, and people were talking about synthesizing all these proteins from scratch in order to build life forms. And my feeling about that was and still is that this is, it may be informative, but I don't think that's really the best approach to take, because there are all these perfectly good tools already sitting there. And they're already working together, and we know that they work, and why don't you just pull parts from living organisms? It's a little less glamorous, because that's a lot like genetic engineering that we've had for 30 or 40 years. but I would agree with this guy that that's probably where the future is really going to lie.
This is so cool, right?
It is. It gets you to think about how things are assembled. But I have another thought here, too, though, and that is that I am now watching a very fine Swiss watchmaker. And he's got these drawers, multiple drawers in front of him, right? And he's missing one of the components.
Is he blind?
No, that's another book, Vince. And you can build the most elegant-looking watch in the world, but without that little wheel that he's missing, the whole thing is just not going to work, because there's an ecology to the way these parts fit together. It's not like Lego in that sense. Mm. It's more complex than that. There's a molecular ecology to the way cells are assembled. And everybody who's done electron microscopy realizes that there's a tremendous amount of missing information every time you look at a cell, because it's leached out of it, and the only thing you're seeing is the protein networks that are left behind, right? But when you start to think about how all these domains, like now they have these names for these things, right? The proteasome and the thisosome and the thatosome and the otherosome, all of these things don't just float around in space inside like a soup. They're all interconnected by special connectors, which allows the flow of information to go from one place to another. So just having a parts assembly line doesn't mean, for instance, that if you had them all laid out in front of you at the Ford assembly plant, you could make yourself the fastest car in the world, or even the car that these things are supposed to be made into, because you don't know how they go together. And the problem is that we haven't learned to climb inside of a living cell yet and look around and see the way it is. But I think we're coming to it. I think that's the next big breakthrough, is to climb inside of a living cell, a normal living cell, and take a big look around and see what's going on.
Right. And the problem we have is not a shortage of good parts. It's the crappy documentation.
Here are just where do they go? A to B to C to D. I have no idea of how this thing goes together. That's the problem. That is the big problem.
Well, I think that's why he's saying we need 30 to 50 years to learn how to put these together. Yeah.
Bacteria might allow that because of their simplicity, but even they are not simple. 3,000 genes, that's still a
I like his analogy with programming, though, right?
It's good.
I mean, I never thought of it that way, but you have blocks of code that are used for different things and put them together, right?
Modern computer programs use a very biological paradigm with object-oriented programming, and the objects are organized in an inherited hierarchy,
right?
Very much like biological entities.
Well, all of the big fears, of course, through the science fiction writers is that the machines will organize eventually because they'll achieve a certain level of complexity.
Isn't that the singularity?
Or the Terminator syndrome.
I was listening to an NPR show on the singularity a couple of days ago. It's an interesting
idea. As computers get smarter than us, right?
Never. Yep. They can't. That's impossible.
Dixon.
With a trillion connections in our brain. I think we underestimate ourselves in that sense.
Yeah, but we kill each other. That's the problem.
Oh, big
deal. All right, that's for another. That's a cool email. Thank you.
Yeah.
Now, next one is from Brett. Hello, I've been a fan of TWIV since I learned about it at this year's American Society for Virology meeting in Bozeman, and I very much enjoyed a conversation I had over lunch with Vincent at that meeting. In recent TWIV casts, two people independently asked whether viruses infect muscle cells and whether they infect mitochondria. Flockhouse virus, FHV, does both. Myocytes are rich in mitochondria. FHV is a positive strand RNA virus, a notovirus that primarily infects the muscle tissues of insects and reorganizes the outer mitochondrial membrane to assemble the viral RNA replication machine. Some beautiful tomographic images of these machines were published a few years ago by Paul Alquist Group. He sends us a paper. Other notable features of this virus are that it encodes only three proteins, a replicase, a capsid, and an RNAi inhibitor. It replicates to very high levels, ribosomal RNA levels, and it has been shown to replicate in a wide variety of cells from diverse eukaryotic organisms, insects, its natural host, mammals, and even brewer's yeast. FHV gets its name from the Flockhouse Agricultural Research Station in New Zealand, where it was discovered.
Cool.
Apparently, there was a plot of land that lost its grass except in large circular patterns where the grass continued to grow. It turns out that a grass grub was eating the roots of the grass and destroying it, except in these large patches where the grubs were being killed by a virus, FHV.
Cool. It was a plaque.
It's a big plaque. That's right.
Finally, crop circles have been explained.
This was a plot virus.
So this virus was discovered by a very large colony-forming assay where the diameter of the colonies was measured in meters.
Actually, Grant McFadden once in a seminar showed, he was talking about the Myxoma experiment in Australia, and showed a map of Australia and showed it was colored in where all the rabbits died. And he claimed that was the largest plaque that was ever.
Cool. I didn't hear the word rhabdomyosarcoma virus mentioned.
No. What's that?
Should it be mentioned? Well, it's a
replicating in muscle.
Yeah. Rhabdomyosarcoma is a cancer of muscle cells, but the origins are not clear. And I just wondered if any progress has been made in that level, because when I was doing work on Trichinella, that was one of the experimental models that we used to see whether Trichinella could actually make a nurse cell out of a rhabdomyosarcoma cell, and the answer was yes, it could.
Well, there are certainly retroviruses released from rhabdomyosarcoma cells.
There you go.
Whether they caused it or not, I do not know.
Right, because you can induce it with nickel chloride, which sounds weird, doesn't it?
It does sound weird.
You inject nickel chloride into a muscle of a mouse, and the next thing you know, you get a rhabdomyosarcoma.
Brett continues. Brett, by the way, is Brett Lindenbach, who is an assistant professor at Yale. He's a virologist, works on Hep C. The high levels of FHV RNA replication remind me of a thought experiment, one that cannot be done under our prudent biosafety policies and NIH funding, but one that I find entertaining nonetheless. I imagine that it would be fun for virologists to trick out their favorite viruses, gather together for a Friday night fight, complete with beer and pipettes, and set their viruses against one another in a cage match for fitness dominance. The winner, of course, would be the one who has the most genomes at the end of the match. Trickier virologists would design their viruses to specifically target their competition or to inactivate cellular pathways needed by their competitors. In particular, I wonder how poliovirus would stack up against FHV. Vincent? I further wonder what would happen if the competition were relatively equal and if the match was allowed to continue. Would a new virus be created, an amalgam of the two competitors? Well, just some crazy thoughts to entertain me between writing grants and running my lab here at Yale. Thanks for the great podcast and keep up the good work. That's a cool thought experiment.
Virus smackdown.
And in fact, it is a great question for a final exam in a virology course.
There you go.
Anyway,
well, what occurs to me reading that is that that experiment's going on all the time anyway. Just that we're talking about the whole planet, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Right, it's just not being properly monitored.
It is true. But in any case, polio would win.
The Alquist paper that he sent along is really terrific.
It's a great paper.
I think the virus that shows the highest mutation rate might come out ahead.
Yeah, this is a very interesting paper.
I'd put my money on that one.
The three-dimensional analysis of a viral RNA replication complex reveals a virus-induced mini organelle. This is a study of the flockhouse virus-induced complex by tomography. It's very
beautiful. The other hand, as computational biology progresses, I think that would make a pretty good video game.
Ooh, yes.
Here, here.
It would.
Yeah. Sorry.
All right, let's move on to some picks of the week, Dixon.
Okay,
Vince. Is that a good idea?
It is. Very good idea.
Who should we start with? Let's start with Rich. Rich Condit. Is he there?
Rich?
I'm here. I had my microphone muted. Sorry. I fake out now.
I thought he left us.
Yeah, I've got a throat clearing problem here, so I'm kind of in and out, and sometimes I'm not in.
Okay, go ahead. What have you got for us, Rich?
This was pointed out to me by a guy that I met at a meeting a while ago who had an iPad that he was absolutely addicted to, and it's a periodic table. He had it on his iPad. There is an iPad app for this. It's actually a lot more dynamic than the website. I don't have an iPad, but I've got the website here. And it's basically a very interactive and very colorful, very dynamic and complete periodic table. So it's just a periodic table laid out that's got some sort of representation of each of the elements, and as you pan through, you can see those come up, and then you can click on it, and it's got a bunch of data about it, and he updates it now and then.
They just announced number 117, by the way.
Oh. So I thought just a nice demonstration of the periodic table.
It's nice. They have videos, too.
Yep. And in the iPad version, it's very animated, you know, all these things turn around, and I forget which one it was. There's helium or something like that that bubbles up and whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
One of the first things we should make every graduate student do when they come to their first class is try to name all 92 elements.
Oh, forget it.
You know? I'm not kidding. Have you ever tried to do that? It's very difficult.
Well, you know, my son in high school just had to memorize them all, but he forgets them after the last test, you know?
Right. I can look them up.
But, you know, I had a wonderful discussion with my wife on this last trip about the difference between organic and inorganic. She was very confused about this, of course, as most people.
What's the difference, Dixon?
Well, of course, you know the difference, Vince. The organic molecules are the ones that are reflected in life.
Aren't they carbon, the ones with carbon?
Carbon, but not only. I told her that sometimes nitrogen compounds can be considered organic as well. But then it raised a larger question of what's meant by inorganic and organic chemistry.
Is carbon dioxide organic?
It's got carbon.
Is it organic?
I would say so.
Depends, Alan, on what kind of feed you gave it.
That's right. It doesn't necessarily depend on where it came from, but it certainly is a building block, that's for sure.
It's not organic.
But it raised a very fundamental issue of our basic understanding of life and of just the physical environment that we live in. And that's a great thing to put forward, Rich. I highly commend you for it, because I've been doing a lot of thinking about the periodic table lately. I don't know why, but just as a curious scientist.
It comes up periodically.
Stop it. Just stop it. Let's table this discussion.
The periodic table is very cool. My son studying it and me helping
It's remarkable.
I got back into it, and it's very neat.
It's remarkable.
It is very cool.
I've seen it represented as a spiral, by the way. And rightly so, because you can make the proper associations this way with the metals and the halides and et cetera by doing it that way.
It's the same site as the same site. The guy has a lot of other stuff that he does, and if you cruise around in it,
it's
one
cool.
of the things you will find is a wooden table that's actually the periodic table. It's a periodic table.
Very good.
I'd like one of those.
Oh, right.
Cool. Thank you, Rich. Dixon Despommiers, what do you have for us?
Well, you know, I'm going to give you the generic take on an article that I read, and I'm blocking on what I read it, although I think it was Science Magazine, because I still subscribe and I still get it at my breakfast table every morning to sit down with it and study it. The original paper that was published that claimed that autism is caused by vaccination.
That's your pick of the week?
That's my pick of the week, because they accused the senior author, the only author that's left on the paper that claims to have some authorial claim to it, has actually been accused of faking the data, basically.
Yeah, that was a nice investigative piece by a reporter.
That's only about a week old, though.
Alan,
which is ongoing, in fact.
Mm-hmm. How do you think that looks to you, Alan?
Well, it's. I think this guy, this investigative reporter, whose name I've just suddenly blanked on, is. I think he's up for a Pulitzer Prize. This is an amazing series that he's doing for BMJ.
Right. I mean, first it was looked at as faulty data, and then it was looked at as faked.
Brian Deere.
That's it.
And who is the senior author that still clings to the? Results?
Andrew Wakefield is the guy who clings to the results. So what Deere has done is dig into this. He's been kind of digging into it for a number of years. But this series that he's putting out in BMJ, he really, really, I don't even know how he dug this deep, but he managed to track down the kids and parents from the original study.
The 12 that were involved.
Yes, the 12 people who were in the original study, tracked them down.
They weren't even suffering from autism, some of them,
Some of them did not have autism.
Right.
Some of them, the onset was pre-vaccination.
Yeah.
It just, like, all sorts of things didn't line up at all. For a lot of the parents, this was the first time they'd ever even seen these data. And then in the most recent part two of this thing, which just came out the other day, January 11th.
That's right.
He goes into this scheme that Wakefield apparently had, a series of businesses that he'd started secretly that would have been making a profit from people fearing this connection. And essentially, these were going to be companies that would... that would do tests to determine if your child was injured and help out with litigation and all this.
Sure.
They were estimating how many tens of millions of pounds they were going to make off this. So Deere has now gotten the documents from these companies, and It's very disturbing, but it's an incredible piece of investigative journalism.
So how many lives Vince lamented when I just came over before our show started that this guy should be considered as a murderer because of all the children that died because they didn't get vaccinated because of this false data?
No, let's see. The Jenny McCarthy body count will go there.
Yeah. Is that still online?
It sure is. Number of preventable illnesses, 73,000. Number of preventable deaths, 624. That's from June 2007 to the present.
Now, you don't know how many of those people who died, parents, knew about this false study and didn't vaccinate as a result.
Right.
You don't know the connection there.
That's the missing link.
And but I'll bet you this guy Deer is going to go back to every one of those 600 people and ask them.
Well, the problem is that, of course, once the Wakefield paper came out, then a lot of parents jumped on it, and Jenny McCarthy and other famous people started saying, yeah, this is right. And as you know, people listen to celebrities more than they will listen to scientists. So got a lot of momentum. But it's very hard to put a number on it, but it's very unfortunate. So, Dixon, there is a website from Brian Deer here, briandeer.com, where he has all his articles.
You know what?
That'll would you like to pick it?
I would pick that then.
All right.
Yes, I certainly would. And I think and Alan
fact,
and I
Brian
would pick
Deer
it together.
Was also, he was one of the main folks who uncovered the Merck Vioxx story.
Really?
You know, of course, with this vaccine autism thing, I'm sure some of the anti-vaccine crusaders are going to say, oh, well, he's a tool of the pharma industry. But that doesn't really jive with the earlier work that he did, particularly when you consider that Merck is big in the vaccines business.
Yeah, yeah.
Disclaimer, of course, my spouse works at Merck.
Yes.
Yes.
Someone wrote once a while ago that we should all disclaim things. And so I'm disclaiming that. I don't know what else. What do you have to disclaim?
Recuse. Well, I once had a parasite. Maybe I should recuse myself from this week in parasitism.
I don't think that counts.
No, I have firsthand experience.
All right, that's good, Dixon. The Brian Deer investigative report.
And it raises the larger...
I wasn't aware of that. That'll be very interesting.
The larger issue of fraud in science is the main theme here, and it's been a theme since there's been a science literature.
Next week, I believe our guest on... Twiv, let me just check the schedule.
Yeah, I think it's next week.
Seth Noonan, who is the author of The Panic Virus on this whole Wakefield incident, which came out before the Brian Deer report, by the way. But we'll be talking to him. I know Alan can't make it, but if you are here, Dixon.
I will be here.
He will be joining us via Skype, and we can talk about his book. Did you get his book?
I did, and I've started reading it, and my goal is to have it done by the time he's on.
That should be fun. He's looking forward to it. Seth Noonan is a writer. He doesn't just write about science, but he's written for Vanity Fair. He has a few books. I think he has a book on the Boston Red Sox.
Yeah.
And The Panic Virus.
Right.
It's a cool name. Alan, what do you have?
I have really more of a concept than a specific site, but I do have a couple of sites for it. 2011 is the year of the bat.
Really?
The baseball bat?
Not the baseball bat.
No, not the baseball bat. The UN Environment Program, UNEP, and some other organizations have declared 2011 Year of the Bat. They've had other animals in earlier years. But, of course, bats have come up a number of times here on TWIV. And there are a couple of cool sites, yearofthebat.org, and I put another link to a blog about this, and you can read about bats and the cool things they do and updates on news about them. They're really, really fascinating critters, and you can also find at least some bat-related events at museums and conservation areas. I see... Rich, you just missed in November. They had the wild night out at the Luby Bat Conservancy in Gainesville.
Yes, I need to go. I need to go see this sometime. Eric Donaldson, when he was down here, pointed out to me that there was this whole bat facility down here, the conservancy, that I was not aware of, and it's by and large private. But once a year, they open it up and have this big thing. And I need to attend that.
Yeah, and then apparently it was the sixth annual Florida Bat Festival.
Huh.
So in November next year, this year.
Very cool. Nice. All the time of we were down at the Yucatan this last 20 days, we saw bats flying during the daytime.
Is that bad?
Well, I don't know. These are daytime bats. I mean, there are daytime bats also. But I learned from Peter Daszak, who's at the World Wildlife Federation, that over 20% of the mammals on Earth are bats.
That's right.
20%. That's a lot.
One of the first things I ever heard you say, Dixon.
Well, I learned it from him. And maybe we should have him on as a guest sometime, too, because he's very big on Nipah virus and things like this, which is a bat-transmitted infection.
Absolutely. Can be done.
Yep.
That's a good pick. The year of the bat.
The year of the bat.
They got some very cool pictures on this blog. Cool.
Yeah. And so we're suffering from white nose disease right now, I guess, huh?
Yep. We are. Not me, but the bats.
What will happen if they disappeared? That's a good question.
Bad things, I suspect.
Well, rabies, goodbye. But that's a small thing to get
the
rid of.
The insects would take over.
The insects would have. Well, something else would come in to take their place, though, don't you think?
Maybe.
Wouldn't it be cool if there were a program that could simulate all this?
Oh, yeah.
Where you would take the bats away and see what happens to the
ecosystem?
It's a complicated data set, but...
That's because we don't understand what the bat does.
Yeah, we have so many variables we don't understand.
Tough one.
Exactly right.
Well, my pick is a game.
Oh.
It is a game, and I have along with it an article in the Times that talks about it. It's called ETE, A Game to Design RNA. It's a lot of fun. It's very basic. But you go there, you open an account, it's free, and it teaches you about the principles of RNA, the four different bases, and you have to build structures, base pair things, and you go through different levels, and you move up in your standing as you do this. So I was playing this the other day. If you don't know much about RNA, you will learn all about it here.
Wow.
It's a very educational game.
Why do we do everything like that?
Plus, it's very visual. It does nice graphics as you get things right. So it says, for example, it gives you a linear molecule of RNA, and it gives you the four bases, and it says, make four base pairs, knowing what you know about which bases go together. And you do it, and if you get it right, you get points, and you go on and on. It gets harder and harder and harder, of course, and you're playing against other people, and there's a little chat room on the right where people are talking as they're playing too. So it's a cool game. It's developed by Carnegie Mellon and Stanford Universities, funded by the National Science Foundation, who I think should fund TWIV, by the way.
You betcha.
Yes. Good idea.
Oh, and apparently, if you win this weekly competition in the game, they synthesize your RNA.
Really?
And score how well it folds.
It's very cool.
Huh.
Neat.
ETE, RNA. There you go. And that'll do it for another TWIV. We do this every Friday, more or less. And the episodes go up on Sunday. You can find them at iTunes, at the Zune Marketplace, or at twiv.tv. As always, send us your questions and comments to twiv@twiv.tv. Dixon, good to see you again.
Hey, Vince.
VerticalFarm.com. How is the Vertical Farm?
Actually, the book is doing remarkably well.
Very good. I'm happy for you.
My publisher is very happy with
it. Are you working on the next one?
I am.
What's that about?
It's called The City as Ecosystem.
Excellent. Looking forward to it. VerticalFarm.com and medicalecology.org.
And trichinella.org.
All good websites. Thank you very much. Alan Dove, thank you.
Always a pleasure.
Good to have you back. AlanDove.com. And I understand you're going away.
Yeah. I won't be around for the taping of the next show, but I will be around.
Whither goest thou?
Have fun wherever.
Yep. Going to have a little vacation.
Somewhere warm.
Yes.
Get away from that Massachusetts cold.
Tell you all about it when I get back.
All right. Have fun. And Rich Condit, thank you.
You're quite welcome. It's always great to be here. Good fun.
University of Florida, Gainesville.
Gators. Where we do strawberries.
Bees. Bats.
Sounds like a really interesting place.
It's an interesting place.
It's a fascinating great place.
They do viruses, too.
You bet.
Really good. Bunch of good virologists
and good parasitologists there as well.
Yeah.
No, it's a well-rounded school. I admire your school, Rich.
Well, thank you very much. I enjoy it here. It's a great place.
bit.ly/poxdoc. I'm Vincent Racaniello. I'm at virology.ws. You have been listening to This Week in Virology. Thanks for joining us. We'll be back next week. Another TWIV is viral.